We have a new show at Turpentine that's been in the works for a long time, Company Breakdowns. We dive into S1s and Series B and beyond companies, interviewing founders and investors to break down the companies. First episode is on Rubrik, which IPO'd this week. Upcoming episodes cover Reddit, Databricks, and more. Subscribe at the link in the description or search for Company Breakdowns on YouTube or in the podcast platform of your choice.
My famous phrase is that we need to figure out how to redistribute respect. When I say redistribute respect, I just mean increase the total amount of respect in society. In Japan, everybody's just polite to everybody and nice to everybody in a fast food place or in a Starbucks. Nobody thinks they're like, man, I had to defer to this person. I had to bow and scrape to this person. How dare they? I'm subordinate and these people's group is taking over in America and we got to kick them out. No, they don't think that. They just think like, sumimasen, you know, like, come on.
Welcome to Econ 102, where economist Noah Smith and I make sense of what's happening in the news, technology, business, and beyond through the lens of economics. Let's jump right in.
Hey, Noah. How are you doing?
It could be worse.
Welcome back from Japan.
Thank you. It's good to be back, except for the jet lag part.
You had a good trip? It was what you wanted?
Well, no, it wasn't what I wanted. What I wanted was to see some cherry blossoms, and I ended up being very early because the cherry blossoms were delayed by about 3 weeks. And then they were blooming right as I left. And then they reached full bloom after I left. And I had to see all the pictures and videos of the amazing cherries right after I spent a couple weeks in the cold and rain.
That's bad timing. Well, we finished our series on analyzing economies and now want to get back to talking about some of your posts alongside some mailbag Q&A.
Let's do it. I want to turn this podcast into like a, you know, a sort of a Q&A, you know, blogger office hours podcast.
Awesome. Well, we've got some great submissions. So people listening in, keep sending. We'll send the email in the show notes where you can write in and let's get to it. Well, first let's start with the pieces and then that'll segue into some of our questions too.
Yeah. Okay. But first, before we do that, I want to point something out. Do you know how I have jet lag? Because my voice is really deep right now. It's deeper than normal because I just got up because I'm so jet lagged that I'm sleeping all morning. And so usually, you know, when we do these podcasts, I've been up for a few hours and my voice is already like 3 octaves higher than it is right now. But when I get up for about an hour, my voice sounds like really deep. And so that's why you can tell that I'm jet lagged.
Good to know. I didn't pick up on it. Well, thanks for waking up to doing this podcast. And with that, let's segue into why is the U.S. doing so much deficit spending? Let's talk about government spending.
The reason we're doing deficit spending is because it seems to have worked. So in the Great Recession, we did some deficit spending with Obama stimulus called the ARRA. We did some deficit spending and it did work, but it was, you know, the Great Recession was so bad that it didn't totally solve the problem. It didn't really blast us back into recovery. Maybe if we had done five times as much as Paul Krugman wanted, that would have happened, but it didn't happen. And so we did what we did, but we were very, very much restrained by all these people calling for austerity. They didn't completely win, but they did. But in, you know, 2011 or so, the Tea Party Congress, you know, sort of did the debt ceiling showdown. This is all sort of lore right now of the Obama years. And Obama himself was a fiscal conservative. Obama, by the way, was just in general more conservative than Americans will ever like realize or give him credit for. You know, I think they think he was super, super lefty because he was black. But no, he was conservative. You know, Obama was sort of our Captain Sisko from Deep Space Nine in a way. You know, he was very conservative and just in terms of his instincts, not in terms of like who he allied with politically. So Obama believed in austerity. And the Tea Party Congress believed in austerity, and together they enacted austerity. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of progressives learned the lesson from this that, you know, you should always fight for maximum stimulus. You should always fight for maximum, you know, spending and, you know, and low taxes as well. Although nobody talks about this, a lot of the stimulus that Obama did was tax relief, temporary tax cuts. And then when we do deficit spending, some part of that is because we're, you know, taxes are low, right? So like a large lot is that spending is high, and some is that taxes are low. So, so anyway, a lot of Democrats on the leftist side, you know, progressives, they not leftists like, you know, the crazy socialist people, but just like, you know, regular progressive people, not even to the Bernie Sanders level, but just the, you know, Robert Reich or people like that, you know, Paul Krugman or just your general labor aligned lefties, you know, not leftists, decided that a big fiscal was the answer and that we should have spent a lot more to stop the Great Recession in its tracks. We should have just poured on the government spending. We should have done massive stimulus, and then we would have gotten out of the Great Recession faster and it would have been better. Now, historically speaking, for such a gigantic financial crisis, we actually got out of it pretty fast, right? The actual financial crisis stage was over pretty quickly, thanks to bailouts. And then the economy was growing pretty strongly again 4 years after the shock hit. It was not a Great Depression, right? 4 years instead of, you know, Great Depression lasted, I don't know, 12 years about. And then it was a lot less severe than the Great Depression as well, in terms of unemployment and things like that. So we really did cushion the blow a lot. It was just a bigger blow than we had received since the Great Depression. So everybody was sort of upset anyway. And what progressives learned was that you go big. You know, you go big or go home. You spend a lot of money. You run big deficits. It's fine. Politically, there was also this sense that that our fiscal responsibility was this one-legged stool, and that first Reagan and then George W. Bush had abandoned fiscal probity and austerity. They had abandoned, you know, balanced budgets for political reasons. You know, Reagan wanted to dish out big tax cuts and do a defense buildup. George W. Bush wanted to dish out big tax cuts and do wars, of course. And so, you know, without raising taxes to cover these things. And so, you know, Reagan didn't actually tax us to cover his defense buildup. Bush didn't actually tax us to cover his wars. So we did a bunch of deficit spending in both cases. And basically it seemed like, and you know, Republican Congresses, when they had them, just rolled over and said, okay, that's fine. You know, we're going to abandon our traditional role as budget hawks. And so I think a lot of Democrats thought, okay, wait a second, we're being jobbed here. We are being the, you know, unpleasant, you know, we're being the bad parent, and Republicans are the nice, friendly parent who just like, you know, Republicans are being, yeah, like they're just handing out candy, right? And then we're the ones who have to tell the kid to like wash up and go to bed, put away the candy, stop watching TV, go to bed. And so Democrats had to do austerity. First, they did austerity under Clinton, and then they did partial austerity under Obama. And they thought, okay, something's wrong here. Like we're being forced to bear the burden of this. Why? This is not fair. Republicans have decided, as Dick Cheney once famously put it, the deficits don't matter. So why don't we just decide deficits don't matter either? So I think those two things, the overlearning the lessons of the Great Recession and a political calculation that deficits don't matter, combined to make progressives really strongly inclined to believe in quote unquote big fiscal, i.e. run big deficits to make the economy better. And then, of course, COVID came and, you know, our economy rebounded very, very quickly from COVID. Was it because of big fiscal? Well, maybe some of it was. You know, we ran the economy hot. We were willing to dish out more generous COVID relief. And by the way, I should note that a lot of that was Trump, that the CARES Act was actually more generous than either of the other two acts because it was sort of in an emergency situation. But then after that, they did another sort of supplemental CARES Act. And after that, Biden was elected. And then Biden did the American Rescue Plan in 2021, which shifted the focus of stimulus from small businesses to, like, you know, paying for stuff for people like healthcare or whatnot. But it still was basically a fiscal stimulus, even though by that time we were starting to exit the pandemic, but people didn't realize that until 2022, I suppose. So we're starting to exit the pandemic, and we did all this spending, and inflation went up and growth went up. And this is, you know, our growth really strongly outpaced other rich countries' growth. And why did it? Well, maybe it's big fiscal, right? We also had higher inflation for a while, although now we have lower inflation than those places. But we had higher inflation for a while. And so people were like, okay, big fiscal, it worked. You know, like we deficit spent our way out of this massive shock. We did the thing. We got it right this time when we got it wrong in the Great Recession. And that was the thinking. Now, that thinking is flawed. because the COVID was not the same kind of shock as the Great Recession. The Great Recession involved a financial crisis, this massive overhang of debt, and all the evidence that we have shows that recessions with big financial crises and overhangs of debt happen, you know, they take much longer to recover from. COVID was this short, sharp shock, you know, where it was not even a supply shock, really. It was just, you know, people were prevented from working because everyone was scared to go out and whatever. We didn't really do like lockdowns, but people were just scared to go work. So that was different. And, you know, when I interviewed Paul Krugman in 2020 for Bloomberg, he said, no, this is not going to be like the Great Recession. This is not going to last that long. Now, Paul Krugman is like, thank you, big fiscal, you know, but at the time he was saying, this is not like the Great Recession. This is not a similar situation. And so, but I think that nuance is lost in a lot of people. And so now, you know, with Biden's reelection bid coming up, a lot of these people think, well, it would be really stupid to do austerity right now and cause a spike in unemployment. So I think that basically the reason we're doing all this deficit spending is so that we can keep the job market humming, keep everyone with a job going into election season.
That makes sense. And the reason we care about the deficit to begin with is to the extent that it adds to the national debt, right? And so when does it become a problem?
Well, when does the national debt become a problem? The answer is we don't know. So the first thing that happens is that when interest rates go up, then you start having to pay a lot more interest on your debt. And for a long time, you know, especially after the Great Recession, we had very low interest rates for a very long time. And that's why Trump didn't feel any pressure for austerity. There was no popular pressure for cutting the deficit. You know, people would say on surveys, oh, the deficit's a problem. But you know, candidates weren't really running on cutting the deficit. There was no, like, it wasn't like the early 90s when everyone was like, cut the deficit, goddammit. And, you know, there were debt clocks going up on walls. And it was a really different time because interest rates were much higher then. So that even though the debt was smaller, interest costs were, you know, really high. It was like 3% of GDP. We're spending 3% of our entire GDP paying interest on the national debt. And that's a lot. That tends to crowd out other budgetary priorities. And so the interest costs are spiking again. You should look at interest costs as a percent of GDP because GDP is, you know, potential tax revenue, essentially. So you should look at interest costs as a percent of GDP, but they're back up. They're not back up to early 90s levels. They're back up maybe half of the way. That's a problem. And we're still, and the thing is that COVID's over, you know, pandemic's done, and there's no reason to give people special relief right now. But we are still running deficits equivalent to some of those we ran in the Great Recession. You know, we're running deficits of 5 to 6% of GDP. That's a lot, right? Normal deficit would maybe be 1.5-2% of GDP because when I say normal deficit, what I mean is that the deficit grows by about the same rate that the economy grows, right? So suppose that you're getting a 10% raise every year, right? And suppose that your amount of debt increases by 10% every year. Okay. Well, you're probably okay. Okay. Because as your income is growing, you're taking on more debt. You're able to handle it because your income is growing at the same rate as your debt. And I would call that normal. Abnormal deficits are when you increase your debt at faster than the rate of GDP growth, which we're doing now, even though we have good GDP growth. Say we have GDP growth around 3%. Some quarters it gets up more than that. Sometimes it drops below that, but it's, you know, about 3%. That's really good. That's good for us, right? Because given our underlying demographic situation and the fact that we don't build a ton of like houses and factories and stuff because of whatever regulation, that's actually pretty good growth, 3% growth. And the thing is that our debt is growing much faster than that. It's growing at 5%, 6%. For a couple of years, for 2021 and 2022, that was actually masked by an interesting factor, which was inflation itself. So inflation erodes debt. Because when you borrow a certain number of dollars. And remember that inflation just erodes the value of a dollar, right? So with inflation, you know, corporate profits and personal incomes are going up fast. And, you know, the dollar amount of debt is not going up of the old debt that we borrowed, right? Our big stock of debt. So inflation actually eroded some of our debt for 2 years. And so deficits didn't seem to be a problem because our debt was being inflated away. Inflation is like a partial default. It's like a mini default on debt. And so just like in the post-war period when we had inflation from other sources, we were inflating away some of our debt. And so the problem is masked. Now that inflation has mostly gone down, it's not all the way down back 2%, but it's it's way down from where it was. Now that inflation's gone down and deficits have only fallen a little bit, really not a huge amount, we're starting to see the debt to GDP ratio go back up. And there's no good reason for this. You know, our economy's doing great. COVID's over. We're not doing a military buildup yet, though maybe we should, but we're not doing one yet. And so there's no, we're not borrowing for anything. We're just sort of on autopilot with this.
Yeah. And the ways to sort of reduce, when you think about the deficit, there's government spending and then there's taxation, right? That's the flip side of that. And the ways to reduce the debt, either you could, you know, reduce the deficit, you can increase taxation, you know, economic growth adds more income, you know, inflation, you can inflate away the debt. Like, I'm just thinking about what are the overall levers of dealing with the debt.
You can inflate away the debt, but people will get really mad and kick you out of office. So don't do that. Although, I mean, Trump will try if he gets elected because Trump loves low interest rates. He just, there's almost nothing he loves more than low interest rates because he is a debt guy. You know, he's a real estate guy. He loves to be able to borrow cheaply. So. Yeah, so inflating away the debt, probably a bad idea. Sometimes it happens and it's just sort of a happy side effect of something that's overall bad. But what we need to do is raise taxes and cut spending. So taxes are actually pretty low right now. People don't realize that. Democrats stopped it with the tax hikes a while ago. You know, tax hiking Democrats, that's like an old stereotype. Like, they haven't done that in a while. In fact, the last time they did that, it was because the Tea Party Congress sort of forced austerity and tax cut, and Obama bargained. So the tax cuts were like, I don't remember, 25% or something of that. But Democrats has lost their habitual love of tax hikes. And so, but we need to do some. One of the reasons the deficit spiked a bit last year was because of sort of a delay. There was some weird timing thing with corporate tax cuts and with like the amount that the Fed sends to the, anyway, blah, blah, technical stuff. But the point is that we could be raising more in taxes than we are right now. We are at sort of a low point. And during Clinton's years, we were at a high point in terms of how we were, our taxes that we were raising is like 5% more of GDP than it is now. That's huge. If we could actually raise it to that level, we'd almost entirely balance the budget. If we could raise tax collection to the level relative to GDP that it enjoyed during the Clinton years, we could start like basically almost balance the budget entirely. Almost like, you know, we're at 5-point-something% now. We could, you know, bring down the deficit by like almost all. And so why don't we do that? Well, a couple of reasons. Number one, Democrats are scared that tax cuts will hurt the economy and Republicans don't like taxes. So nobody likes taxes. Number two, you have to work at that. You know, you have to really crack down and really try hard to raise taxes. So we could, more realistically, we could raise taxes by, you know, 1.5 or 2% of GDP. You know, that's will feel like a big tax hike. It won't be nearly as big a tax hike as we had in the 90s during the age of austerity. You know, people remember the 90s as a good time. So I don't think that's going to really hurt us that much. But so I think we need to raise taxes and we need to, you know, cut spending too. Although I say that, but then I also foresee us having to do some increases in military spending. So it's basically back to Reagan sort of. So we're interestingly facing a situation unlike that which we faced in the 80s or 90s, because in the 80s, we wanted to do this big military buildup, but we also cut taxes under Reagan. In the 90s, we raised taxes and cut spending on the military because the Cold War was over. Actually, a Cold War is ramping up now. And we've got to like raise taxes too. So you know, it's gonna be tough. What can we cut spending on? Healthcare. Unfortunately, like, you know, one reason to cut spending on healthcare, you know, and it's, am I saying that granny should have less healthcare so that we can buy more bombers? Well, yeah. I mean, that's because you know, otherwise granny's gonna be in a very bad way if you know, China takes over the world. Or East Asia or whatever, granny will be worse off. So that's going to be a hard sell to the American people, not a sell Trump's going to make. I don't even think it's a sell that Biden's going to make, honestly. But then I think it's something we need to do. For right now, we're stuck sort of like repurposing military spending from other things to, you know, sort of shuffling military spending around and trying to get more bang for a buck. That's neither here nor there. The point is that why cut spending on healthcare? Well, because it's pretty price sensitive. There's a lot of monopoly power in the system. So when you cut spending on healthcare, you get a bit less services, but then what also happens is that the profits of providers goes down. And of course, the healthcare industry, which is one of our biggest and most influential industries, one of our powerful industries, is not going to like this, right? They're not going to like this at all. And So that's going to be a hard sell. But you know, a lot of the money being sort of slopped into the healthcare system has got to recede. The tide's got to go out. So, you know, we've got to have a bargain where we raise taxes on the rich, you know, and cut spending on some of these things where the government is feeding the profits or pseudo profits. You have some nonprofits who effectively make profit but don't book it as profit in the healthcare system. So profits or pseudo profits, we're going to have some of those go down. That's going to be tough. Our nation is going to have to make some sacrifices, and that's a long conversation we're going to have over the next few years. In the meantime, nobody wants to do that before this election, and you know, I doubt Biden want to do it even after being elected, but there will be more pressure to do so. Honestly, the person I think most likely to enact austerity is Kamala Harris, because first of all, Kamala Harris has an incredible political tin ear, and people are not going to want austerity, and Kamala Harris is going to like listen to expensive consultants who like listen to bloggers who say that we need austerity. And so she'll do, you know, she'll be more likely to suggest it and do it. Also, I think, you know, she has experience in city governments, which are forced to do austerity naturally. And so I think she has experience sort of like with tight budgets, whereas Obama mostly went straight to like national politics, where deficits are less of a constraint, or at least less of an immediate constraint. Anyway, that's all amateur psychologizing. I think that, yeah, Kamala will probably be our most austerity-minded politician. Whether she can win an election is highly doubtful. I don't think she can. But Pete Buttigieg, I think he'll be more pro-austerity for similar reasons to Harris. Gavin Newsom, I think, will also be. So I think Democrats may be more austerity-minded just because of the people involved. Maybe Gretchen Whitmer, I don't know. But then Republicans are not going to be. You know, Republicans don't give a shit now.
This actually segues to a listener question. I want to segue to the mailbag questions. Elijah Below from OSU, he wants to hear about whether the 2024 election, in terms of if Trump or Biden wins, what would the different economic outcomes be as a result of that?
Well, so Trump has very little fiscal or monetary prudence. So Trump wants lower interest rates. That's going to raise inflation, because right now, high interest rates are what are keeping a lid on inflation. There's the underlying factors pushing up on inflation are a little higher than they were before. And if we cut interest rates a lot, then we'll see, you know, a continued high employment, but also accelerating inflation again. So I think Trump will be inclined to do that. And he will be inclined to fight the Federal Reserve on interest rates. And he has little regard for, remember, the overriding thing is that Trump wants to not have any institutions which are directly under his power, right? And so he wants to you know, he'll fire Powell. He will bring in someone who will just lower interest rates a lot, and because he loves low interest rates. As for deficit spending, I think that he will try to do deficit spending too. And so Republicans will tell themselves that, just the same way Democrats are currently telling themselves, Republicans will tell themselves that high deficit spending is needed in order to win elections from the evil, horrible, woke Democrats who would otherwise sweep to power if we, you know. So we better not be the one to do austerity. Remember that Trump was the guy who was unwilling to bite the bullet and just withdraw our final troops from Afghanistan. Biden had to do that. Trump is not the kind of guy to bite a bullet, right? He's the kind of guy to throw a party. Even if the world is crashing down around him, he wants to throw a party. And so that's what Trump is going to do. Biden, it's harder to say. Biden, you know, he's Biden's so old that it's basically about like what his advisors want to do. So it's harder. It's more opaque and harder to see. I think that there will be more voices like, you know, Larry Summers type people calling for austerity, and they will have fierce, vicious fights with the progressives. And I think that Harris will probably line up on the non-progressive side. She'll line up on the austerity side, I think. That's my guess, but I could be wrong. You know, again, I'm not really an expert on politics, so that's that. But I it's pretty clear what Trump will do. It's not as clear what Biden will do.
You mentioned that Trump will, you know, likely cause more inflation because he loves low interest rates. How can he, if he wanted to bring about low interest rates, which would be good for VCs, of course, how could he bring them about? What are the levers?
Fire Powell and appoint someone who, you know, appoint a Fed chair who's pliant, who does Trump's bidding, and who loves the idea of lower interest rates. Now, they have a problem doing this. They have a big problem doing this, which is the entire bench of Republican-aligned, GOP-aligned, conservative-aligned monetary policy people are all hawks. They're all a bunch of gold standard people. By the way, like, it's so funny when I see VCs like, you know, saying like, we need hard money. Look at all this inflation. We need the gold standard. That will crush your business. You'll be a poor person. What are you talking about? Like ZIRP is so good for VCs. I don't understand it. What, okay, Eric, you give me insight here. What's going on there?
Well, I think, as you know, VCs are just very first principle oriented people. And there's, when they see the simplicity of what they think of as sort of the, you know, just hard money, they think this is elegant. This makes sense. This will prevent sort of, you know, corrupt or, you know, middlemen from trying to sort of steal from the public in you know, via inflation. And so they fall for that kind of just so story because they don't understand the kind of the labyrinth that is the economy and what that will mean for their business.
Right. It's like, man, ZIRP is so good for VCs. Yeah. High interest rates just absolutely taint the market. I don't know what people are thinking. Like, generational suffering, 25% of San Francisco tech jobs, I think, evaporated. I don't know, guys. All right. So, but that's what's going on. Basically, Trump will point a crony to the Fed.
Let's go to another question. This one from Chris Peel, also related to a previous conversation. Do you support a wealth tax? And more broadly, can you talk about the different tax mechanisms that can their various pros and cons?
Right. A wealth tax looks great on paper because a couple of reasons. Number one, wealth tax basically taxes, you levy the same tax on good entrepreneurs and on, you know, heirs, right? So you level the same tax on Jeff Bezos that you do on Jeff Bezos' ex-wife, okay? So what happens then? Well, Jeff Bezos will be able to invest productively and recover to overcome the wealth tax while his wife will not. She'll just lose the money. So you drain, basically you weight your economy away from these, you know, heirs, people who inherit their money, or in her case, she got from divorce, but you weight it away from the useless rich people toward the actually useful rich people. Okay. That's what's nice about a wealth tax. It's also sort of just one more thing you can do to, you know, crack down tax evasion, because it's easier to evade a million layers of taxes than it is to just evade like one income tax. So that's what wealth tax has to benefit it. Wealth tax has some big downsides. One, we're not sure it's legal in America because of the Constitution. We do have wealth taxes, actually. They're called property taxes. They operate at the local level. So the tax evasion benefits, actually, you know, cracking down tax, it's actually not much because you have to build this whole new bureaucracy because it's currently we don't even track wealth, right? We only know wealth because of surveys. We send guys around to just ask a few rich people how much wealth they have. From that, we infer how much wealth the other rich people have with the survey of consumer finance. That's all we do right now. But you know, here we'd have to build an entire new bureaucracy to track wealth, to track assets. And that's really difficult. So that's hard to do. And then it turns out that wealth taxes, as taxes go, are actually pretty easy to evade. You just put your money off the books. And so it turns out that wealth taxes, you can even store wealth overseas too. And then you have to build another whole bureaucracy to go track down that. And you have to have international agreements to crack down on the tax havens. And so it becomes this giant game of whack-a-mole. It's actually hard to collect. And so European countries mostly abandon wealth tax. So wealth taxes probably have more cons than pros, even though on paper they have some pros. There is a thing we can do that achieves all the benefits of the wealth tax with practically none of the downsides, which is just called raise the capital gains tax. You know, just so capital gains taxes wealth at the point of entry, right? Capital gains taxes wealth when you cash out some of your wealth, right? Your stock went up, so you sell it. Like, I just realized that when doing my taxes that my wealth has doubled, and that is due, a lot of that's due to asset appreciation. I put all my wealth in stocks went up. I'm richer now. Yay me. Probably should have put it in housing for tax benefits, but I didn't. I put it in stocks. So anyway, my wealth went up. That was great. Yay me. Beer is on me. But I haven't had to pay taxes on that yet because I haven't sold yet. So I haven't paid the capital gain. I haven't accrued the capital gains, so I haven't actually used it. So you get the capital gains tax, capital gains tax hits you when you try to use the money, right? When you take out, you cash out. So the capital gains tax is actually not very harmful to the economy at all, because what it does is, you know, on one hand, it might reduce investment a little bit because people think, oh, I should invest less because it's just going to get taxed away. But then really that's pretty much exactly canceled out by the fact that people will be more likely to keep their money in the market, because if you withdraw your money from the markets and invest less in financial markets, you actually just incur a bunch of capital gains tax. So the desire to leave your money in the market for a long period of time kind of cancels out the desire to like not invest in the first place and just consume instead. And really, those are pretty small incentives in the first place. So capital gains tax is pretty harmless to the economy. We should tax it more. We should also, more importantly, we should eliminate these step-up bases. So right now, if you leave the assets to your kids, they never have to pay taxes on the capital gains that you accrued. You just get away with it, you know, and those capital gains never, ever get taxed. So we need to eliminate that law so that capital gains, you know, are actually taxed when they happen. So we need to eliminate the step-up basis, and we can just raise the capital gains tax rate, and that will work like a wealth tax, but better. And you can say, oh, but there's all this like accrual happening, you know, like Noah, your wealth on paper doubled, and then you're not paying any taxes on that. And I'll be like, well, yeah, but like in the end, if people, you know, it doesn't matter, right? In the end, like wealth you can't use is not wealth, so it doesn't matter.
That makes sense. We're actually staying on taxes. The all-in folks, in the last episode, they talked about how when we get above 20%, I guess, I can't remember what that 20% is, but basically they say it starts to hurt the economy.
Well, I don't know what they're talking about. So do we ever really know what the all-in people are talking about?
We'll continue our interview in a moment after a word from our sponsors. Hey, everyone. Eric here. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from our AI and investing cluster of podcasts to shows that drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, investors, and influencers, like Econ 102 with Noah Smith. We're launching new shows every week, and we're looking for industry-leading sponsors. If you think that might be you and your company, email me at ericaturpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K at turpentine.co, and let's partner together.
In terms of Laffer curve, you know, that's Laffer curve is actually about how much revenue you get from taxing. And the Laffer peak is the idea that if you raise taxes too high, then you'll actually start to reduce the revenue that you're getting simply because like no one pays taxes, and you know, you crush economic activity and everyone just spends all their effort trying to avoid taxes. With the Laffer curve, that the Laffer peak is somewhere upwards of 70% taxes. So like we're not there, you know. If people are paying over, like we're not nearly there. And so, but on corporate taxes, the Laffer curve may be lower. It may be somewhere around 40%. So that's what motivated Trump's corporate tax cuts. Anyway, we'll get to those in another episode. But yeah, so we can still get more money from taxes. We are not near the Laffer peak right now. In fact, yeah, our tax rates are reasonably low. We can just repeal the Trump tax cuts. So the Trump tax cuts actually have given me a big tax cut because I'm an S corp. My business is an S corp. That's what Substack is. Or you can make your Substack in S corp. So I do, and you know, I get a tax cut from Trump. Thank you, Trump. As do all the other Substackers. The blogosphere thanks you, Donald Trump. Rolling back some of Trump's tax cuts, I think would be helpful. Also, you know, when we fund the IRS more, we actually get a ton. We collect a ton of taxes that we already have on the books. We don't even have to raise taxes at all. We just fund the tax police and we collect the taxes that people owe and just aren't paying. So to some degree, we can do some of that. That's what Larry Summers advocates. And in fact, Biden has done a bit of this and it did improve tax collection.
Yeah. This was, okay, segue to another mailbag question. My friend Phil Levin writes in and says, hey, Noah, can you talk more about sort of government spending as a percentage of GDP? And we're trying to reduce spending. What are the levers by which we can reduce spending? Because a lot of people think, hey, there are too many employees, you know, or too many people employed by the government, but employment is a small percentage of the government spending. So reducing that wouldn't really, you know, make a dent. So where are the levers?
Honestly, we need to hire more people for the government because we need them to hash out, like we need them to basically fight the thicket of regulations that we have ourselves passed. So we've had like NEPA. We need government people to like be working on all these NEPA reviews and passing these things and like straightening out the border crisis and all this stuff. So we actually do need more government employees. Fortunately, they're pretty cheap. Fortunately, we don't have that many of them and it doesn't actually cost that much. So our federal bureaucracy has shrunk a lot. Like it's not bureaucracy causing a lot of the federal spending, really not state spending either, but that's another topic. So we're talking about federal spending, right? We're talking about the central government here in Washington, D.C. That is, what are we spending more money on? We're spending, well, more money in healthcare, a lot more money in healthcare, basically. And everybody loves healthcare. Everybody wants to, you know, the one problem is that when you spend a lot more, you don't necessarily get a lot more. So I mean, everybody talks about, like, you know, housing is this as our biggest problem that's gotten so much more expensive. Well, you know, overall in the country, housing has not actually gotten more expensive relative to wages, right? Wages have actually gone up for the average American, have gone up by more than the price of housing. The problem with housing is more subtle. The problem with housing is that it's in the wrong place, right? We don't have enough housing in the big coastal metros, et cetera. Save that for another day. With healthcare, actually, healthcare has just gotten more and more and more and more and more and more expensive. But the problem is that that healthcare is also how a huge percent of Americans make their living. We make a living treating each other's diseases very inefficiently. We make a living on overpaying for care. We call it care, but what it really, a lot of it is just paperwork and runarounds and unnecessary stuff, right? So, you know, the progressives will always be like, you're getting more care. We're caring for you. And then, like, what's actually happening is someone's making you fill out the same goddamn intake forms 1,000 times, mother. Yes. So that's what actual care is here. Or just like, we'll give you another MRI for your knee. Fine. Go ahead. Or things like that. There's a lot of useless stuff. Or, like, you know, $2,500 for a hospital pillow, like one of those hard little shitty little pillows. Like, that is care. That's the care you're getting. You know, and there's this progressive fantasy of, like, well-paid middle-class nurse, you know, like, cradling you in their arms. Like, that's from porn. In reality, you have to fill out a form and you're paying $2,500 for a crappy pillow, and, like, no one has, and still no one has the time to, like, you know, talk to you. But instead, like, there's 20 times too many people doing redundant procedures and filling out redundant forms and blah, 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 and all, a lot of this waste. Well, it's a, you know, it's great for, like, an employment sink that we can just employ people into. And in the 1960s and 70s, that actually made sense. We actually needed to employ more people in healthcare, but we just kept going. And so we're not rationalizing this industry. We're just hurling more money at its gaping, ever-hungry maw. And we're incinerating a lot of our productive potential. When I talk about our productive potential, when I talk about, you know, skilled people who are walking around filling out medical paperwork, those people could be building semiconductors. Those people could be, you know, yeah, doing a lot of the building batteries, building cars. And China thinks this way. So Xi Jinping basically is like, yeah, okay, so we're not going to do any of that healthcare stuff. You know, we're not going to do any of this. Like, we're not going to do finance. We're not going to do software. We're not going to do education. We're not going to do healthcare. We're going to do manufacture. We're going to make cars. We're going to make batteries. We're going to make computer chips. We're going to be a tough, strong nation, blah, blah, blah. And China's doing too much of that, right? China's overdosing on that. But remember, in economics, it's all about that middle path, that internal solution, that optimum level that you want to, you know, got to walk with kings without losing that common touch or whatever the poem says. You know, it's a Rudyard Kipling teaching everyone what an internal solution to an optimization problem is. Thank you, Rudyard. I also like the movie Disney's The Jungle Book. The monkeys were very cute. So then, and the bear, he was very cute. No, but so the point was that we need to go a little in the direction of Xi Jinping, and Xi Jinping needs to go a little in the direction of us. Remember, China is just America where the Republicans always win, you know? So, like, that's basically, China's just us, but, like, 4 times as big and with the Republicans always winning. That is a problem. You can't have the Republicans always win or you have a problem. China doesn't have any Democrats. They have the Republicans who are just the CCP. Sorry, Republicans, but, like, if you look at the things the CCP wants to do, like, back in Mao's day, obviously they weren't Republicans. They were just some crazy thing. But, like, now they're just like, well, we don't want welfare. We don't like, you know, we don't like welfare. We like manufacturing. We don't want gay people on television. We don't want girly men. We want traditional gender roles. We don't want kids to play video games. We want people to work in a, you know, munitions factory and, like, you know, all these things. They're the Republicans. And yeah. And so basically, that's what's going on in China. China needs to go in the direction of us, but we need to go a bit in the direction of China. We need to be doing less walking around pretending to treat each other's diseases and a little more, like, manufacturing stuff. And I'm sorry, but spending less on healthcare is part of the way you get there.
And the second part of Phil's question, what percentage of government spending should be GDP? Like, is it 40% or should it be 50% or 20% or what's the right way of thinking about?
There's no magic number. There's no magic number, obviously.
But it's been increasing over the decades, right?
It has been increasing, but, well, it increased a lot It mainly increased a lot after World War II. So there's this huge, huge increase. World War II built the modern state. The things we did for World War II never stopped. And it changed the idea of what a modern state should be. Almost no country doesn't do this. Singapore, on paper, looks like it spends a lot less of GDP, but actually that money is all spent by government-controlled mega corporations, so that the true off-the-books amount that Singapore is spending relative to GDP is probably just as high as every other country, right? When you had Temasek and all those guys. Yes, so every country is pretty much converged on this, government spending about, 35 to 40% of GDP. That's including federal, state, and local. Should we be spending more than that or less than that? I can't tell you, but I can say that there's a remarkable convergence. Despite, independent, and I'm talking about like dictatorships too. The idea that you could have substantially less than this, no country is really providing us a good example of what that would look like. All right. And so I don't actually know the magic number, and there's no theory that sort of guides you, because remember, there's no theory about government spending in general. Government spending is spent on discretely different things. You can spend it on the military. You can spend it on healthcare. You can spend it on interest on the national debt, which has nothing to do with any of the rest of the stuff, right? You can spend it on roads. You can spend it on, pointless bureaucracy. You can spend it on helpful bureaucracy. You can spend it on, education, all these things, right? There's no one single unified theory of government spending, because government spending is a whole bunch of different items that we just book in the same expenditure category. So I can't tell you what's right. What I can tell you is that nobody seems to be deviating that much from the average.
I want to segue to another mailbag question. Our listener, Chris Peel, also asks, to what extent is economic inequality a problem in the U.S.? And if so, what should be done about it? And then relatedly, do you buy the idea that more redistribution would make us all richer? And if so, what level of redistribution would you see as the correct level?
So that's a huge question. That's actually too complicated to answer right now. The answer to inequality is that we actually don't know which type of inequality matters the most. Inequality primarily matters to the degree to which it pisses people off. And, you go on Twitter and you see some billionaire saying, ha, 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 I'm so rich, her. And then maybe that makes you mad, but that, it's just because you got Twitter. It's just because you got on Twitter and you saw the billionaire being a jerk. And, that didn't happen last week, but the billionaire doesn't have any money than he did last week. Or you get fired at your manufacturing job and you start doing lawn care instead. And now you see what these mansions these rich people are living into. Before, you never went into, Beverly Hills. Before, you never went to Atherton, right? Whatever. You never went to these expensive neighborhoods. And so now you see it. And so the degree to which inequality is visible, the degree to which it makes a difference in our material lives, the degree to which it makes a difference in our social status and our perceptions of ourselves, whether we're a winner or a loser, these matter a lot. And none of these is captured by the economic statistics at all. And so, Brad Long talks about this a lot too. We don't actually know what kind of inequality matters. And because we don't know what kind of inequality matters, we don't know how to effectively address it. We know that generally, when normal people have good economic opportunities, then, they feel a little less mad. I have this theory that weighting our economy a lot more towards small business than we do would actually help with this, because it would make more people feel like they've got a stake in the capitalist system. Like, they are business people. They are capitalists. Japan does this. Taiwan does this. Oddly, Germany does this. And I think that this sort of deep base of small capitalists would actually help us a lot. We focus a lot on high growth entrepreneurship. Everyone wants to make the next NVIDIA or whatever. Is that what we're on, by the way? Or do people say the next NVIDIA, the next OpenAI right now? What do they say?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. We're past the next Google. No one wants to make the next Google anymore. Oh no, I'm old. We're old, Eric. I remember when I was a kid, like, people would say the next Microsoft.
Wow. Okay.
And now they're back. Maybe they're back to being like, I want the next Microsoft.
I haven't heard that just yet, but I also think it's just too daunting.
You'll have to find the next Satya Nadella, which everyone wants to find, right? Everyone wants to clone him. Yeah, so I think that having a big deep bench of small business would help. Inequality, we've spent decades wrestling with this problem, and we don't quite know. When we look at the inequalities that people shout about on TikTok or Twitter, most of these inequalities are not economic. Most of the inequalities that people talk about are status inequalities. They're things like, you have white privilege, or, you know, like that was DEI, stuff like that. It's status inequality of groups in society. It's who you feel like you can boss around at the fast food restaurant you go to. It's who you feel you can boss around on the school board. It's all these petty little inequalities that, you know, have basically a wealth tax isn't going to make a damn bit of difference to any of these things. Like it's not going to change the fights in the school board and the sort of like people acting like jerks in fast food restaurants and or slagging each other off on social media, you know, like my group's better than your group. It might be true that economic inequality exerts a corrosive effect on social inequalities such that, you know, when economic inequality rises, you know, people get stressed out. People at the bottom get stressed out, or when economic opportunity is low, maybe it's not even inequality per se. Maybe it's just stagnation. You know, after the Great Recession, income stagnated, blah, 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 and wealth stagnated, you know, like people's housing wealth went down. And so people just sort of got aggro about that. And so they started thinking about like, well, what if this other race of people is taking all the money, you know? And so then they got mad. And so I think that there could be that corrosive effect, but it's very hard to see in the data, and political scientists will argue about it like day in, day out, but we don't really know. I think that to be on the, you know, the era of the 20th century, we saw concerns about economic inequality very obviously dominate. We saw people on the edge of poverty revolt, overthrow governments, slaughter people. We saw this happen in a very bad way in communist societies. We saw revolts by poor people without slaughtering people. Happened very productively in democratic societies, such that basically social democratic parties were elected or corporatist parties who distributed money through a corporatist welfare state like Japan and Korea. Either way, we saw big social safety nets that really, you know, made people a lot more secure. And so we saw a lot of this stuff. The 20th century was the century of economic inequality. And I kind of think that in rich countries, now, of course, in India, this is still going to make a huge difference, right? In Bangladesh, in maybe in Indonesia, this is going to make a huge bit of difference. But in America, in Japan, increasingly in China, I think that social inequalities and status inequalities are going to matter more to people, and they're going to be more disconnected. Not, I won't say completely disconnected, but I will say I think they're going to be more disconnected from, you know, from economic inequalities than they were before. I think my famous phrase is that we need to figure out how to redistribute respect. When I say redistribute respect, I just mean increase the total amount of respect in society. We need everybody to basically just be nice to everybody in a fast food restaurant, like in Japan, right? In Japan, you know, everybody's just polite to everybody and nice to everybody in a fast food place or in a Starbucks. And nobody thinks they're like, oh, man, I had to defer to this person. I had to bow and scrape to this person. How dare they? I'm subordinate and these people's group is taking over in America and we got to kick them out. No, they don't think that. They just think like, sumimasen, you know, like, come on.
It's interesting because economic growth is positive sum, and or it's more positive sum than status, right? Status sometimes is relative to other people, and you can find ways to expand it, as you're mentioning, but it's not as positive sum as economic growth, right?
Status is zero sum, but respect is not. And that's a crucial distinction because, you know, a billionaire can, you know, stand there and wait for a poor person to walk past them with their tray at the fast food place, you know, or give up their seat on a train. There's a million little interactions or just, you know, shoot the shit with the employees at the factory. Like if you look at, you know, the billionaires who are best loved by people, it's that they talk to normal people and that they just act like a normal person. And not just billionaires either, but like you're a director, you're a M2 at some tech company. Well, you know, you could not treat the DoorDash person like shit for being 5 minutes late. You know, it's just a million little small interactions in our society that could be more, not just more friendly, but more respectful. We could decouple respect from money and income and not think that people who work in the service industry, people who work in normal jobs, regular middle class people are losers. The median personal income in America is somewhere around $40,000, right? That's how much your like median person makes, and half the people make below the median. Half the people in this country make less than $40,000. And of course, that includes retirees, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of people in this country are just making $25,000 a year. We need to not call those people losers, not say you failed in life. life's a game, son, and there's winners and losers. But no, that is a toxic mentality. And that sort of mentality does not scare poor people into doing better. It makes them go be drug dealers, and it makes them cheat, and it makes them commit crime, and it makes them angry, and it makes them beat people up, and it makes them violent. That motto of winners win, losers lose, peace out, bro. We need to get away from that. We need to get to a society where, let's call this a respect safety net, where, you could admire Elon Musk for building Tesla and SpaceX and stuff like that. Sure, you deserve admiration. Fine. Get off Twitter. Yeah, you can admire people for building these things and for succeeding in these ways without punching down on your average regular service worker and your average working class person. The problem, status inequalities have always been a big problem in highly unequal societies. If you go back to Spain before the Civil War, peasants had to bow and scrape when the nobility came by. We don't want that. Even if our nobility worked their way up from the grassroots, worked their way up by their own bootstraps and blah, 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 blah. It doesn't matter for purposes of respect. Yeah, that's cool. Good job. Yay. Here's all your rewards. But we shouldn't punish people who work as a cashier for their whole life. We shouldn't punish them by disrespecting them. And the idea, this sort of 1980s bullyism. By the way, the best show about this that has ever been made is Cobra Kai. The sequel show to The Karate Kid, whose protagonist is the guy who was the bully in the 80s. And now he's just this aging 40-something bully who just feels the world has left him behind. We need to get away from 80s bullyism, and we need to start respecting regular people, because unlike status, respect is not zero sum. We can respect everybody, and living in Japan teaches you this.
Yeah. That's maybe a good place to wrap. Thank you so much, Phil, Elijah, and Chris, for the questions. We have some more questions that we'll get to next week. And please submit in your questions. This is becoming a mailbag show as well. And Noah, this was great. Thank you for joining even on your jet lag. And until next time.
Until next time.
Econ 102 is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Moment of Zen, In the Arena, The Cognitive Revolution, and more. If you like what you hear, subscribe and leave us a review in the App Store. You can keep up with both of our Substacks for written analysis of the topics we cover in the show at noahopinion.substack.com and erictornberg.substack.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey everyone, Eric here. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from our AI and investing cluster of podcasts to shows that drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, investors, and influencers, like Econ 102 with Noah Smith. We're launching new shows every week, and we're looking for industry-leading sponsors. If you think that might be you and your company, email me at erikaturpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K at turpentine.co, and let's partner together.